That's Tipitina, the famous Professor Longhair tune, and it's played and sung there by Hugh Laurie from his first album, Let Them Talk. And I'm delighted to say that Hugh Laurie joins us now from our Brisbane studio. Welcome to the music show, Hugh.
Well, thank you very much.
I know you've always, you know, your acting has always included musical performance. You know, you played the piano in a bit of Fry and Laurie, and you perform in Peter's Friends, and you played guitar as House, and I remember a spirited rendition of 47 Ginger-Headed Sailors from Jeeves and Wooster. But it's one thing performing in character, and it's another when you kind of go out there as Hugh Laurie and perform, isn't it?
It is indeed. It's very, very different, and in fact, it's sort of diametrically opposite. I have this theory that people become actors to hide in one way or another. They put on a mask and they hide their true nature, and performing music is really about taking masks off. I think it's about revealing oneself, if only because you reveal what you love. I mean, that's a pretty revealing thing. I mean, having said that, some of the songs we do, they are characterful. You know, they're about telling stories, and there is drama to them, I think. But you're right. It is a very, very different thing to step out as yourself and play music.
Are you still in character to some extent, do you think?
I'm in character now. Can't you tell? Well, I suppose a little bit. From time to time, there are some songs that just sort of they were conceived as the singer adopting a persona and telling a story about a particular character. And that's not just me. That's some of the other singers in the show also. You know, they will take on they will try and paint a whole picture through the voice and through the character. So, you know, in some ways, I feel like it's actually not as different from acting as it might be. But nonetheless, you are revealing, without a doubt, you're revealing much more of your true self.
Yes.
Through music.
Well, a song like One for My Baby, for instance, the Johnny Mercer Harold Arlen song is obviously, I mean, the point of view is incredibly strong there, isn't it?
It is indeed. It is. And it's such a beautiful, it's almost a sort of note perfect. It's such a beautifully composed story. As someone once said, when Sinatra did the famous version of it, someone said that Sinatra's gift was to tell an entire three-act American story in whatever it is, 2.5 minutes. It's a masterful song.
Yeah, and apart from anything else, you can also see Joe.
Completely. We can all be Joe. And that's, the audience is Joe, I suppose, in there, Joe the bartender. The odd thing, it was actually written for a musical, is that the first performance of it was Fred Astaire in a very graceful, typically graceful and elegant performance as he sort of slides around this barroom. And there you actually get to see a Joe, which, of course, changes the whole emphasis of the song in a way. I think it's much better if the audience is Joe, the bartender.
Yes, yes. And you feel almost slightly weary as well listening to the
yes,
story, don't you?
Exactly.
Joe would be at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
The fact that song is there gives some sense of the breadth of repertory on these albums, that it's not just classic blues, that you're sort of, you know, moving into the great American songbook as well. How do you set about choosing the songs, Hugh Laurie?
Well, it's just a case of trying things on and seeing what fits. I sort of don't know until I hear it, and then I think, yes, that fits us. You know, that's a sound that fits us. That's something we can actually explore. There's no great sort of plan. I have no theory to it particularly, except that in the difference between the first and the second album, I felt the first album was quite sort of rural in a way. I felt we were out on a dusty road somewhere, and we were heading towards the city. The second album, I feel we're getting closer to the city. We can see the bright lights, and we can hear a little more brass, and we can also hear more of a conversation between men and women. That was one of my sort of goals with the second album, was to do something that was more sort of cosmopolitan than that sort of rather rural sound that we had the first time.
And the city, if it's any city, is New Orleans, isn't it?
Yes, for me, that city stands for all cities. Not to disparage the great and beautiful Brisbane, or indeed Sydney, but New Orleans is a remarkable, magical place, and it has been in my. It's been my sort of Jerusalem ever since I first knew of its existence.
And from a musical point of view, I mean, I mean, obviously, well, we just heard a Professor Longhair tune, but you know, guest artists such as Dr. John and the great Irma Thomas, for example, the recordings a strong New Orleans flavor. But is there something about the piano style?
There is. The piano became my. I mean, I as every other teenage boy did. I had my obligatory period of dreaming of being a guitarist, but that actually passed fairly quickly. And I found I used to listen to Muddy Waters records, and I found my ear going more and more to the piano playing of Otis Spann in particular. I used to. Even though he was very sort of buried far back in the mix, it was quite hard to hear what he was doing. But I found myself more and more intrigued by piano players, and they sort of gradually took over and became my musical heroes. Really, I find that they're almost all piano players now.
Yes, and indeed, the songs that you do tend as often as not to be built by piano players. I mean, not just Professor Longhair, but Little Brother Montgomery, Champion Jack Dupree. It's their songs that you're doing as well.
It is, and I'm not quite sure why that is exactly, what it is about the piano that really speaks to me, but it's probably got as much as anything to do with the fact that they sit down. I'm a sedentary sort of a soul, and maybe that just appealed to me. I don't see myself as a, you know, cutting a dashing silhouette up at the front with a guitar. I think I'm a sitter. Yes.
Or on top of the piano like Springsteen, say.
That would take me about an hour and a stepladder to get up there, and the getting down would be ugly. Yeah.
Well, you sort of alluded to being a boy. When did you remember hearing the blues?
I was one. Yes, I was.
When did you hear it for the first time?
I do. It's hard for me to be sure. I think I was probably. About 9, 8, 9, 10, somewhere around then, I heard a song on the radio, and I think I have for years had this idea that it was Willie Dixon, but I've got no way of being sure about that. And it was just like an electric shock. I was hit by a thunderbolt, and I am, believe it or not, 50-odd years later, close to it, I am quivering still from the impact of that first song. And I knew then, I was absolutely certain that this is the music I wanted to lose myself in, be a part of, try and make, listen to for the rest of my life. And I haven't really moved on. There are lots of other things about being a 9-year-old that I haven't moved on with either. Maybe that's my problem. I am arrested.
Do you know what it was about listening to the Willie Dixon song or whatever, whichever song it was? Was it the voice? Was it the instrumentation?
It's something about the blue note, whatever that is, and however one defines that sort of magical space between a, just to be briefly technical, not that I have any theoretical knowledge of this at all, but I'm going to say it anyway. Between a minor third and a major third, that, you know, this gap opens up and you walk into a magical kingdom that, more truly expresses what it means to be human, because we are neither minor nor major. We are both. We are both at all times. We're a combination of sorrow and joy, and that is what life is. And when I first heard that, I just thought, oh my God, this just sums up everything I want music to be, and I've never let it go.
And the fact that it was very much an American music, a Southern American music, a black music, was that part of the attraction? Was there an exoticism, do you think, that this 9-year-old sensed?
I suppose that's possible, yes, that it seemed that there was a sort of romance to this far-off land, which spoke of love and loss and gunplay and whiskey drinking and railroads and all these, and sort of vast, unexplored lands. Maybe that was part of it.
And sex, too, actually.
Yes, sex is certainly, of course, at nine. Yes. I only heard about sex a couple of years ago. I'm shocked, frankly, to discover what's been going on. Yes, it all, you know, all human life is in these songs to me. I think of they make me laugh, they make me cry. There is a vast amount of sex, violence too, sometimes, or the threat of it. There is all human life is there.
And the sex is so often cloaked in culinary imagery as well, isn't it? Every time the kitchen is mentioned, you know it's really the bedroom.
Right. Well, of course, people were struggling, I suppose, as they always will be struggling with, social sensibilities. And there's part of the fun, I suppose, is to euphemize and conceal your true meaning, or at least conceal it enough to get by a censor. But that sort of adds to the pleasure of it, the playfulness of it, and the wit of it. I find these songs so beautifully witty and elegant.
Just doing a quick calculation in my head, you would have been nine in the 1960s, and the 1960s in England were a good time for the blues, weren't they? The blues sort of holed up. To some degree.
They did. That's right, because the American audience, for whatever reason, sort of turned their back on the blues to some degree. And yes, Britain and also France, I think, became very keen on it. And
Scandinavia, too.
And Scandinavia. And they kept the torch burning through festivals and, of course, record buying. There was this this great love and fantastic practitioners, of course. I mean, whatever attraction I have felt for the blues, of course, I am but the 10,000th to have trodden this path. There are many, many British players before me who've were drawn to this fabulous music and reached the, you know, dizzying heights.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I suppose names like Alexis Corner and John Mayall, but also more obviously Clapton and the Stones, for that matter.
And the Stones and Jeff Beck, yes. Who I think has been touring. I feel everywhere we go around Australia, I feel there's a coffee cup that Jeff Beck just drank out of. it's which is, by the way, a fantastic thing.
And not daunting?
I'm constantly daunted. The most daunting thing is to step out in front of an audience of paying customers and try to entertain them. That I find daunting, but it should be daunting. I think that's only right. I think the day one stops being nervous about that as a prospect, one ought probably to stop doing it, because it seems right and proper to be daunted. You know, it's good. It's a good feeling.
You said that you're not in character when you're performing the songs, or by and large not in character,
right.
that you are, as far as possible, Hugh Laurie himself. What about technique, singing technique, playing technique? Are you conscious of that? When you play a Professor Longhair tune, for instance, and you have the prospect of those wonderful sort of skirling roulades that he does on his keyboard, I mean, do you feel that you are... channeling him or impersonating him or what?
First of all, may I compliment you on the phrase skirling roulades, and that is going to be the title of my next album if I'm lucky enough to have one. That's a most fantastic phrase. Without a doubt, I have listened to... I couldn't even put a number to how many hundreds, thousands of hours I've spent listening to Professor Longhair and Dr. John and Henry Butler and all these extraordinary players trying to sort of disassemble what it is that they're doing and sort of reassemble it in my own way. And I am very conscious. I mean, even if I'm playing something quite in a different way, I am conscious of the fact, when I look down at a piano keyboard, I do often think of the fact that I am touching the same notes, the same... I'm looking at the same landscape as Ray Charles. Well, no, actually, that's a very bad example, isn't it, as it happens. He came into my head because I've actually played a piano that Ray Charles had played. And but you know that I'm looking down at the same landscape as Professor Longhair, and my hands are trying to sort of occupy the same or tread the same path. Mm. It's one of the most moving things about it. I feel I am following the masters, and that's a glorious feeling.
Yes. And what about the voice? I mean, because there is some distance between your experience of life and that of a sharecropper, say, who sang some of these songs for the first time.
Without a doubt. But you see, I've thought about this. Well, I have actually thought about this for decades, because for obvious reasons, it's been so dear to my heart. And yet I was so aware of the fact that I am not of the experience that generated this music. But the position I came to was that this is art. This is art. And in the same way that we allow a Chinese tenor to sing Puccini, there is nothing that should exclude anybody from the practice of art. And if we say that only people who have had this particular experience are qualified, then we're actually, what we're saying is that we don't consider it to be art. We're saying that it's a sort of folk curiosity and nothing more than that. I don't accept that. I think this is the American, the great vast contribution that America has made to the world's culture, which is to say jazz, is as high an art form as there is. And I think for that reason, everybody ought to familiarize themselves with it, know it, take pleasure from it, contribute to it, and keep it alive. Because I think to treat it as something, an exhibit in a folk museum, I think is actually to diminish the life that is present in this extraordinary art.
Mm. And yet it is a folk music, isn't it? And
Oh, it is, yes.
And one of the things that distinguishes it as a folk music is, well, I suppose they're clichés, really, aren't they? But I mean, we talked about culinary imagery standing in for sex, but, I mean, the blues are full of musical and verbal references which just come back over and over again. You know, I woke up this morning being number one on the list. And so you're dealing with familiar objects almost every time you sing a song, even if the song itself is unfamiliar, and you have to breathe new life into that, don't you?
Yes. I mean, it's funny because I actually don't, that's not actually how I think of it. I think you're right, but I am sort of managed to blot out that side of it. And I'm actually thinking back over the two records, I'm not sure that there's a conventional, well, first of all, I don't sing. I woke up this morning.
You've avoided that so far.
Even though I did, that is one of the few experiences that I can share with the early blues singers. I did wake up this morning. But we don't actually have any conventional 12-bar blues. The songs we are playing, they have a blues element to them, but they are, we have a tango, we have things with a sort of skiffle feel, we have things with a country feel, things that have almost a sort of church gospel feel. And each one of them, to me, stands alone as a unique, precious stone. And I don't sort of worry too much about it being part of a particular style or a genre, or how do we sort of change this to make it seem. To me, they're fresh enough. It feels to me as if they were all written at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Working with Joe Henry, of course, who has been the producer on the albums, is a very good way of freshening up any material, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Joe is the cleverest, the single cleverest thing I did, or maybe the single clever thing I did, was to approach Joe Henry. I had listened to, at the encouragement of the record company, I'd listened to all sorts of different producers' work, and I kept going back to these albums that Joe Henry had done, one with Alan Toussaint. He did a fantastic album with Solomon Burke. And also, of course, his own records. And I kept going back to these, thinking, this is how I want to sound. This is how there's a directness and an honesty about this. That it has no, there's no trickery. Joe is not a sort of Pro Tools guy. He's not a sort of he's not a sampler. He's not, has no interest in any of the sort of box of tricks that is available to so many. Possibly, one might argue, too available to modern record producers. He is about the truth of the thing, the story, the musicians in the room, and how they speak to each other, and nothing else. Anything that gets in the way of that, he's not interested in, and he's resolute in that. And he was also, I may say, a man of exquisite taste and encyclopedic knowledge. And best of all, we got on. I mean, the first time we met, we just hit it off so well. I thought, this is going to be my brother in arms. So it's proved to be.
In the 1970s, I was living in Yorkshire, and somebody told me that champion Jack Dupree lived down the road.
Was it Hull?
Halifax, actually.
Halifax, that's right.
And, we were talking about Britain being good to the blues, but this is sort of a particularly extreme example. And there's a champion Jack Dupree song on the new album, Didn't It Rain, which I think we should listen to. But maybe you could say something, Hugh Laurie, by way of setting up Junkers Blues for us, or indeed Champion Jack.
Well, Junkers Blues is an eternal. Nobody even knows who wrote the first version of Junkers Blues. It's been around since, junk was invented, I would imagine. Champion Jack Dupree is one of my favorite piano players. I listen to him. It's possibly more than almost any other. He would probably never. By the way, he was called Champion Jack Dupree because he was a champion. He was a boxing. He was a prize fighter, as so many of them were. Professor Longhair also earned a few bob in the ring, and he was. I'm sure Champion Jack Dupree would never have said, he's the greatest piano player in the world. But there's something about the way he tells a story through his playing and through his singing. That I just, it gets the hairs on the back of my neck absolutely every time. I love, love, love this man. And I wish that I had had the opportunity to meet him. And if I'd known early enough, such a thing was possible. I think he lived in Halifax for a good 20 years or so.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Hugh Laurie, it's been a great pleasure talking to you on The Music Show. Thank you very much indeed for stopping by.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you very much for having me. We've had the most fantastic time. The audience has been absolutely amazing. And this band, frankly, you have to hear them to believe them. They are quite something.
This is Hugh Laurie from his album, Didn't It Rain?
Some people call me a junker. See, I'm loaded out of my mind, but I just feel happy. I feel good all the time. Some say I use a needle. Some say I sniff cocaine. That's the best damn feeling that I've ever seen.